Steve get the lights for us. Let's go ahead and turn to Ruth chapter 3. We're in our third week of four in the book of Ruth. Brief summary to get us from where we were to where we are. In our first week, we met a man named Elimelech and his wife Naomi and two sons. They took off for the land of Moab. Anybody remember why they took off? What was going on in Israel? You guys remember? Yeah, famine. And they were likely in time of famine because of their disobedience. When we went through the book of Judges, we saw that Israel would go through this period of apostasy and then oppression by their enemies. God would then reach down and rescue them, and then the cycle would sort of start all over again. And so they were in a period of famine. And so Elimelech and his family took off, went to a place called Moab, which is really a territory of enemies with Israel. And they spent about 10 years there. The two boys married two Moabite women, and then tragedy struck. Anybody remember what happened? Yeah, who all died? All the men, yeah. And so it left Ruth, Naomi, and then Orpah, Ruth's sister, alone, widowed in a foreign land. And so we kind of see in that this setup, if you will. A good story always has to have something that gets resolved in it. And so we basically have this tragedy, and now the rest of the book then is spent on sort of resolving that tragedy. And through that we get glimpses of God's providence and His sovereignty. We get glimpses of loyalty and faithfulness and graciousness and goodness. And we see that in all these characters. And one of the things we said when we first started this was that the neat thing about the book of Ruth is that it has that contrast with what was going on in Israel at the time with the judges and this amazing family, or these individuals, all of whom we can emulate. And we already began to see that in the first week and in the second week. One of the things we could see in Naomi was her care and affection for her daughters-in-law. I remember when after all their husbands had died and she decided to return back to Israel because the famine had been lifted, she tries to get her daughters-in-law to go back to their homes so that their daughters would be able to remarry and be taken care of, because in that culture and society in the ancient Near East, it was important for women to be married. They had difficulty surviving on their own. And so she tries to get them to go back and says, I've got nothing to offer you. And so we see Naomi's care and concern for her daughters, and she basically begs them to go back. Well, then we see Ruth beg her to stay, didn't we? And so we saw the same thing in Ruth as she was expressing loyalty and devotion to Naomi. And that's interesting because there shouldn't have necessarily been any loyalty to her. They were enemies ultimately of Israel, the Moabites were. And to go back into Israel would mean that Ruth would not have much hope, because the chances of her finding a husband in a foreign land like Israel weren't all that great. And yet she clung, the text says, to Naomi. And you remember the confession that she made, your God is my God and your people are my people. And so we saw that Naomi was a follower of Yahweh. In fact, she uses the covenant name of God, Yahweh. And so we see her clinging to Ruth, not just because of who Ruth was. I mean, clinging to Naomi, not just because it was her mother-in-law, but because of her commitment to the Lord. To go back to her people in Moab, a land that she no longer was a part of, or a people that she was no longer a part of, her devotion and loyalty was to Yahweh, her God. And so we see this neat interplay as we go throughout this book with this loyalty and faithfulness. And we're going to see that continued now as we get into chapter 3. And we're going to now get a better picture of Boaz. We saw Boaz's kindness last week, you know, as Ruth went and worked in his field and Boaz took notice of her. And we saw this man who apparently had a great relationship with the workers in his field, something that was not necessarily all that common. And so we began to get a glimpse as to who Boaz was, and we're going to get a little bit better picture today as well through what takes place. So Ruth chapter 3, we're going to look at the first five verses here. And this is where Naomi comes up with a plan to provide security for Ruth. Let's go ahead and look at the first five verses of chapter 3. The author here writes, "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman, with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley in the threshing floor tonight. Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you should do. She said to her, all that you say, I will do. So we see Naomi here coming up with this plan. She starts with a rhetorical question for Ruth. She says, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Some of your translations may actually use the word rest. Or should I not seek a home for you? I think the NIV and the NET take that approach. The idea there, the Hebrew word actually literally means rest, but it was an idiom for finding security in the home of a husband. And so what Naomi basically says here as she looks at Ruth is she realizes that Ruth had just got done winnowing in Boaz's field, and she begins to see the providence of God taking place here. And so immediately she looks at Ruth and she says, shouldn't I now provide for you? Shouldn't I find a place for you of rest? Shouldn't I find a husband ultimately for you? Now this normally would have been fairly difficult again for Ruth because she was a Moabite in a foreign land. And as we remember, Israelites really weren't supposed to marry Moabites. It wasn't exclusively forbidden if they had come to the Lord. The Old Testament makes that pretty clear. But so it would have been a difficult thing. And so Naomi, we see here, is looking out for Ruth. She's looking out for her future. She expresses the same care and concern here that she did earlier when she tried to get Ruth to go back. And so we already now begin to see the providence of God unfold here. The second question she has for Naomi is this. Or for Ruth. Now, is not Boaz our kinsman with whom's maid or maids you were? The Bible here says relative or close relative, which is a literal translation. But they've identified Boaz here as somebody who could fulfill the Old Testament practice of kinsman redeemer. We're going to see that in a little bit here. So what we find is that Naomi is now looking at Ruth and realizing the importance of who Boaz is and what Boaz can now do based on the Old Testament law. And we're going to get into this a little bit later, but this idea of being a kinsman meant that there was a close relative that could now marry a widow to provide for her. And we'll get into that in a little bit. And so that's what Naomi recognizes here, and she begins to, I'll call it scheme, if you will. She begins to put a plan together to make all of this come into play. So she's got an idea of how she's going to provide for Ruth, and she comes up with this three-part plan, if you will. Let's go ahead and look at that. First one, she says, she wants Ruth to go and wash herself, it says, and anoint herself, put on her best clothes, and then go down to the threshing floor. Now you can imagine there's probably not a whole lot here to the washing idea, except that she was probably pretty stinky from being out in the field all day. Remember, she was out collecting grain. She had been out in the heat all day, and so Ruth says, well, go wash yourself up, anoint yourself, which means to put on some oiled perfume, probably doTERRA, if my wife had anything to do with it. Says to put on her clothes. The word best is supplied there, but it simply means a mantle or a shawl of some kind. And so she puts on basically some nice clothes. And then she's told to go down to the threshing floor. Now, the threshing floor is where they would beat out the grain. They would take this grain from the field and bring it in this large room where it was open on both ends so that the air could blow through it. And they would take the wheat or the barley and they would throw it up in the air. And as the wind would come through, sort of a tunneling effect, it would blow away all the chaff and the grain would then fall down to the floor. So the more they would do that, it would purify the grain and you'd end up with the good food grain on the bottom and all the chaff would get blown out. And she says here to go down there because Boaz is down there in the threshing floor. And what's interesting about that is normally you wouldn't expect the owner of the field to be down there doing that. But we've already seen that Boaz is somebody who apparently enjoyed time with his employees. He actually sat with them and ate with them. And so it's kind of remarkable that you would find him down there, but it's important to the story because of what's about to take place. And so we see God's providence here as well in moving Boaz to be down there doing something that would normally be the job of a servant. But again, we're seeing this neat character of Boaz. Nothing was apparently beneath him. So the first part of the plan was that Ruth actually take and get herself cleaned up, put some nice perfume on, put on some nice clothes, and then go down to the threshing floor. The second part of the plan is how Ruth was actually supposed to approach Boaz. So I say here she was supposed to approach him in stealth mode. Look at verse 3. Tells Ruth to go down to the threshing floor, but then says, but do not make yourself known to the man until... And she gives her specifics. So she was to wait until he had finished eating and drinking and he'd laid down for the night, the text says. And then she was to go down to his feet, uncover his feet, and lay down at his feet. Now, some scholars have suggested the phrase or the passage as a whole refers to sexual activity. There's nothing in the text that indicates that at all. In fact, probably the furthest thing from it. We're to take this literally. She just was supposed to go up to his feet, uncover his feet, lay down at his feet, and then wait. That's all. Nothing else was she to do. This wasn't a turn on. This wasn't to arouse him. This was basically just go down and lay at his feet. Probably to indicate a form of submission, graciousness. So her plan is that she's supposed to now go down and uncover him, lay down at his feet, and then she's simply supposed to wait. And she's told to wait for instructions from Boaz. So she simply says, wait till he tells you what to do. He'll know what to do. He'll recognize what's going on. Now you're probably sitting there thinking, that's a little weird. How many of you kids are thinking, why would she go and sleep at his feet like that? It's a little strange. It's a good question. The Bible really doesn't tell us why. You know? It might be because the whole point is to, in some respects, wake him up. And maybe with his feet being cold. Others have suggested that maybe it's just a way of graciously sort of demonstrating submission to him. And that's probably likely what's intended by the text here. Now, she probably didn't go uncover her feet and lay next to his feet. She probably went, uncovered his feet, curled up next to his feet, and then covered herself, and, you know, take a portion of the covering and whatnot. But not completely, and we're going to see that in a minute here. The thing we have to be careful of here is this is sort of a, it looks weird to us because it's not something we would do. And like I said, some have tried to turn it into a sexual thing. Again, it wasn't intended for that. What's interesting is the fact that the way Boaz responds in a few minutes here, he knew exactly what this was, which means that this had something to do with some ancient Near East custom. And we're going to see that kind of develop here, meaning that even though we don't do it here, even though it looks a little bit weird to us, it meant something to Boaz and others at that time. And likely it was probably some demonstration, again, of submissiveness, a gracious act on her behalf, a kind act on her behalf. And you'll see that in the text here as well. So even though it looks a little weird to us, we have to see it through the eyes of the ancient Near East. Let's move on to the second part of this. Ruth follows Naomi's advice now, and she actually does exactly what she says. We're starting in verse 6 here. Let's go ahead and read 6 through 13. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came in secret or came secretly and uncovered his feet and laid down. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after younger men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do whatever you ask. All my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Now, it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will not redeem you, good. Let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning." And so we have this story further developed here. She's waiting as instructed. She's down at his feet. And it says here that when Boaz had eaten and, when Boaz had actually eaten and drunk, his heart was merry, he went and he lied down, which then sets the table for her to do what she was taught to do. Now, we have to be careful with this too, because how many of you, as you look at this, are thinking he's drunk? That seems to be also a popular interpretation that Boaz is drunk. And part of that's because it says his heart, or that says that he was merry. What's interesting is that this phrase here about drinking and being merry, sometimes it's a reference to drunkenness in the Old Testament, but other times it simply means to be satisfied with a good meal. And that's likely what's intended here. Also, it's interesting because phrases like we're going to see here in the text, the idea of uncovering somebody's feet is never associated with sex, but uncovering one's nakedness usually is. And so we see that in this text as well, that there's just not enough in there to indicate any type of tawdry behavior, whether it's his drinking, whether it's his lying down and being merry, or whether it's the behavior of Ruth here. But he drinks. He's satisfied and satiated, probably after a hard day's work in the field and a good meal. So he goes and he lays down. And then after he's asleep, she goes and she uncovers his feet just as she's told to. She lays down. And then she just waits. It says here that later in the middle of the night, verse 8, that he was startled and bent forward and wondered who was at his feet. Which I think that would startle the rest of us, wouldn't it? You wake up and there's somebody curled at your feet. But it's dark enough to where he doesn't even know who it is. There's nothing mysterious there. He didn't know it was her because it was plain dark. So he's startled. He looks down at her, asks who you are. She responds, "I am Ruth, your maid." I love the way she responds. The submissive attitude that she has here. "I'm your maid." Then she tells him to do something very specific here. "So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Look at his response there in verse 10. "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You've shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after younger men, whether poor or rich." Boaz knew exactly at this point what she was doing. In fact, this idea of covering with the cloak was actually a request to be married by Ruth. And so she doesn't pull any punches here. She comes right out and she says, "Look, I'm Ruth. You're a close relative. You're a kinsman. Marry me. Cover me with your cloak." And he immediately recognized what that was, which again goes back to her behavior here and what she had done was something that was recognizable in that culture. Boaz understood specifically that what she was saying is, "You are somebody who is able to redeem me." And so she was asking for him to do that. And his response to her is one of grace and kindness. What's really cool about this is he looks at this not as a burden and a duty, but he looks at it now as a privilege, doesn't he? Look at the way that he responds. He says, "May you be blessed of the Lord." He says, "You've shown your last kindness," which means what she's just done, "to be better than your first." What was the first kindness? According to the rest of the story here. Do you know? Remember what he said about how she treated Naomi? That was her first kindness. He praised her last week for her faithfulness to Naomi, her mother-in-law. That was the first kindness. And he says, "This is even greater than your loyalty and your devotion that you showed to Naomi." And he says, "By not going after young men, whether poor or rich." In other words, she wasn't driven by her emotions or her feelings. Something else was driving her here. And apparently, it's the law. Because Naomi understood what the law spelled out. Ruth here was living that out in obedience, going and doing what the law had said to do, to seek out a kinsman redeemer. He recognizes that she's not basically doing this because he's rich or for some other reason. And he sees it as a tremendous blessing, not so much an obligation, not a burden in any sense. In fact, he feels somewhat grateful because of what she's chosen to do. So he saw it as an honor for him actually to come to him and to ask to be married by him and to be redeemed by him. Now remember, this word close relative here is the word for the kinsman redeemer, goel, the Hebrew word. And there were two primary reasons for this. Remember what they were? The first one was to provide security and protection for a widow. When a man died and his wife was left alone, if she didn't have any children, she wasn't going to be cared for, which is why there's the burden put on Jews in the Old Testament to care for widows and orphans, the same way that the New Testament puts a burden on the church to care for the widows and the orphans. James makes that clear. Acts chapter 6 makes that clear. So if you didn't have any children, you were left in a very difficult spot. And if the church didn't care for you, in our case, or if the Old Testament folks did not care for you, you were left in a pretty difficult situation. Now remember when she went to the fields, the danger that was involved with that? And it's because not everybody lived by the law. They didn't want widows going through their field and taking their crops. And so it was a very difficult place to be. And we find out next week that Naomi actually had to sell her field. So she was in a very difficult spot financially and otherwise. And so the first reason for the kinsman redeemer was to provide security and protection for those widows. The second reason was if that widow did not have any children, it was to produce progeny. And what I mean by that is the names in Israel and in lineage was extremely important. You had families and you had tribes, and it was important that those names and those tribes continue on. You wanted, God wanted the 12 sons of Israel, basically, to continue their names to be carried on. And so if somebody were to die and he didn't have any kids, what happens to his lineage, his line? It'd be much like when my dad just died. If he didn't have two sons, the Pamperin name would not be carried on within his family. And so one of the things that the kinsman did was he was to marry the widow, produce children, offspring, who took not his name, but the name of the dead husband. And so in essence, providing that that name would continue on. And they actually would be considered children of somebody who wasn't really their father. But they would carry that man's name. And so there were two reasons, primarily, that this kinsman redeemer was established by God in the Old Testament. The interesting thing about this, as you think about what's playing out here, it sets up an interesting contrast, because everything we see taking place here was exactly according to the law. You had Naomi looking to the law for the solution to provide for her. So you had Naomi's reliance upon the law. You had Ruth and her reliance upon the law, carrying those out. You have Boaz now, who's actually living out the law as well. In fact, look at what he says here. We're going to go down into verse 10. It says, "Then he said, 'May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all the people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Now, it is true I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning.'" And so we shouldn't be surprised by Boaz's response here, because he responds exactly as the law indicates that he should. He says, first off, that he's pleased, considers it an honor for her to do what she did. Then he goes on, he says, "You're a woman of excellence. Everybody knows you. Everybody understands you." He sees it as a privilege and an honor to marry a woman like her, which indicates something about her godly character. And again, we have this contrast. She's a Moabite. She's from outside Israel. And yet the author here chooses to use an outsider to represent what it means to be a godly follower of Yahweh. In much the same way that God uses the church to go back and teach Israel what it meant to be a follower of Yahweh. We're outsiders. We're grafted in. But yet God is using us at this time, in the time of the Gentiles, as in some respects a form of judgment on Israel. In fact, we're told that at Pentecost, when God poured out his spirit on basically those who were not his own people, specifically Gentiles, that serves a purpose in sort of pricking the hearts of the Jews. And that's kind of the picture that we have here. And so it shouldn't surprise us here, Boaz's response. But you notice what he says? He's like, "Look, we have a problem here." And so now we get a little wrinkle in this plan of Naomi's. He says that he wasn't the closest. He says, "Now it's true, verse 13, I am a close relative," which means I am legally able to redeem you, "but there's a relative closer than I am." As a godly man, Boaz here strictly observes the law. So in spite of the fact that he's honored that she's done what she's done, in spite of the fact that she is a woman who is worthy, who has a great reputation, as much as he probably wants to marry her at this point, he says, "I can't, because the law doesn't permit me to do that, because there's somebody else that has rights before I do, another relative that's closer than I am." And so even in this, we see Boaz's commitment to honor the Lord through strict obedience to the law. And it's because, as we saw last week, he isn't so much interested in the letter of the law as he is the spirit of the law. He's got the law written on his heart in some respects. Godly character prevents him now from violating the law simply because this is cool. Younger woman approaches me, godly woman, wants me to marry her, but he realizes that he has to follow the law. And so he makes it clear to her that there's somebody else that has the first right to redeem and to marry her. But he tells her, he says, "Look, if he does, then great. You're cared for. You're taken care of. You're provided for. But if he doesn't, then I'll do everything. I'll do it. I'll step up. But he tells Ruth, he says, so stay at my feet until morning. And then rise before anybody could recognize and then leave. He tells her, don't tell this to anybody because it might soil her reputation. If people know that she came to the threshing floor. Another reason why it's probably pretty clear in the text here that nothing else went on. She's still sleeping at his feet. Not a great arrangement if you're involving with other things. So there's just all kinds of stuff again in the text that speaks against that, even though again many try to make it that. So we get this amazing picture here of again of Boaz and Ruth both looking for protection, if you will, and expression of their love for and devotion for Yahweh through obedience to the law. So what happens here after this? Well, look at verses 15 through 18. Again, he said, give me the cloak that is on you and hold it. So she held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her. And then she went into the city. Now, some of your translations may say he, and that's because it's really unclear what the original text said. Some ancient manuscripts say he went into the city. Some say she went into the city. And there's no real way to know. In all likelihood, she, because we find her going back to Naomi here. So, says that she went back into the city. Verse 16, when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did it go, my daughter? You can almost imagine Naomi staying up all night long, kind of anxious, wondering how this is going to work out. So she's there, and Ruth walks in the door, and she told her all that the man had done for her. She said, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law's empty-handed. Then she said, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled this to this day. A couple of things here. Once again, we see Boaz providing for Naomi. 6 measures of barley here was probably about 60 pounds of barley. So a tremendous amount of food. So she takes that back to Naomi, and we find in the text here it says that he specifically did that so that she could take something back to Naomi. So again, we see Boaz is just amazing and godly character. This woman has just come at his feet, proposed marriage in some respects. He agrees to do that, but he's still thinking about his role in providing for not just Ruth, but Naomi. And again, we've seen that throughout this text. You can imagine what Naomi must have felt as she began to see God's plan unfold here. And what's interesting is that she's patient. Notice he says at the very end here, wait. Just wait until you know how the matter turns out. But yet she's absolutely convinced that Boaz is going to do what he needs to do because she says, this man will not rest until he had settled it today. Which means she knows that Boaz is going to do what a godly, righteous man, a follower of Yahweh, should do. And we'll see that next week, that he does exactly that. He goes right to the gate, starts the plan in motion. And in some respects, he's a little bit, he's creative in how he goes about doing it, which is very good. He's got a desire to care for Naomi and for Ruth, and so he'll work that out. So what do we actually do with this story today? One of the refreshing things, again, about this story is just the character of each one of these people. You look at Naomi and her care and concern for her daughters-in-law and the number of times she attempts to get them to basically go home and take care of themselves. And even here now, she's got the wheels turning as she realizes who this man Boaz is and that he's a kinsman redeemer. And so the wheels start to turn. And so she comes up with a very creative plan to approach Boaz and do it in a way that was culturally acceptable, a way that showed a tremendous amount of submissiveness and humility on Ruth's part, the patience that she shows in waiting to see exactly how God would work all this out, the excitement you can see in Naomi here as she's waiting for all that to take place. We see the same thing in Ruth. I mean, her obedience to her mother-in-law, doing what her mother-in-law tells her to do, which is a good quality and a good trait, listening to the wisdom of her mother. You can imagine, and this is something that maybe, you know, again, it's different than our culture, but Ruth was driven here not by feelings or emotions, but by her desire to see God do what God would do according to the law. She was looking for somebody that would provide for her, and she recognized in Boaz, much like Naomi did, a man of character, a man of wisdom, a man of godly heart. And so she had no problem doing exactly what she did. And that's something maybe we don't always understand. You know, we're in a culture where we're driven by how we feel and what we think of as romance and love and all those things. And those are important. But in this text, we really see a bigger picture here that's following God's plan and looking to a godly character who's able to redeem and to provide protection and care. Likewise, we see Boaz's character. Same way, a man who is gracious and kind to Ruth. Who recognizes his role in caring for the family. We saw that develop last week. We see it again developed this week. And so it's interesting as we look at these characters, we see loyalty, we see faithfulness, we see God's provision. You know, to think where we started in this book with this tragedy of losing all their husbands. Naomi losing three, not only her husband, but her two sons. And we see God's providence begin to work out here. So I think it's a neat thing for us to look at that and just think about our own lives and how God works all of that out as well for us. Nothing is by chance. May seem that way sometimes. But God is a God of providence, God of sovereignty, and so we can see that kind of play itself out here. But there's something else in the text here today, and I'll be the first to admit it might be a little bit of a stretch, but I want to share it anyway. Do you notice how God has provided in this story a redeemer for Naomi and Ruth? But it's not Boaz who approaches them and says, "Hey, I'm your redeemer. Let me approach you." Remember that Ruth represents the church, the Gentile church specifically. Boaz represents Christ, the redeemer. And you have to wonder, there's a certain expectation in the story here put on Ruth that she must go, approach Boaz, approach him with submission and graciousness, and she actually asks, "Marry me. Cover me with your cloak." Do you ever think about your relationship with Christ? How God put everything in place. He put the Redeemer in place. Put you in a place that you came to recognize your need for Jesus Christ. But what was required of us? Christ didn't force us to do anything, did he? All we had to do was ask. All we had to do was to come to him. There was an expectation that we basically say, "Cover us. Take our sin. Cover us." He doesn't force anything upon us. And I think there's a neat story in that for us as we think about that, because even though God is providential and sovereign, provided us with a Savior, there's still the expectation that he doesn't force anything upon us. And we have the expectation, if you will, that we have to ask. And it makes me think about all the people that we come in contact with on a regular basis and people we see, you know. They have to ask. God's not going to force them. God can say there's a redeemer. He can providentially move them into places where they come across other Christians and they learn about the gospel, they hear, they see, they taste. But ultimately, God says, you've got to ask. I think there's only one example in the New Testament that I can think of where maybe it's a little stronger than that. Remember when Jesus knocked Paul off his horse? But the general thing, the general pattern we see are us recognizing or people recognizing what Christ has done and then asking. And that's kind of what we see in Ruth here. God, even though he's providential and sovereign, doesn't reach down and always manipulate things and force things to work out the way that he wants them to work out. He basically says, ask. Jesus said, "Come, all who are weary." The picture we get of Jesus Christ in the New Testament is not that he walked around and bonked people on the head. Even in the selection of his apostles, do you notice that it was always up to them to accept his offer to follow him? That's exactly what it was. Jesus didn't make any one of the apostles follow him. He basically said, "Come." And that's kind of the picture that we see here as well, especially since, like I said, Ruth is a type that represents who we are. Boaz is Jesus Christ. But notice also in that Boaz's response. There was no hesitation. I wonder sometimes what kind of joy it brings to Christ when somebody finally recognizes what he's done for them and says, cover me. Does he respond with, about time? Or, you finally get it? I would imagine his response is much like Boaz's. He sees it for what it is. He's honored by it. He's thrilled by it. And he responds just like Boaz will next week, which is that he will not settle the matter, or he will not rest until the matter is settled. I kind of think about that with my own relationship with Christ in terms of how God is unrelenting sometimes. And just when I sin, when I don't behave like I should, when I get lazy, he doesn't rest. He doesn't rest. And he won't rest until the matter is settled, which means at some point, someday, we're resurrected, glorified bodies, he'll rest. So I think it's a good picture for us in terms of how we respond to Christ and how he responds to us. Now next week we'll finish up the story of Ruth and we'll see again this same faithfulness and generosity and graciousness as well as God's providence sort of work itself out as we see how Boaz then finally works out God's plan for Naomi and Ruth. And then we'll also see how that ties into Christ, because at the end of the story, the last few verses of this book show us that the line of Christ goes through Ruth, a Gentile. Again, God's providence and how all of this works out. So we'll go ahead and we'll end with that. I would encourage you to read ahead as you're reading in the next chapter, and then over the course of the next week here, just kind of reflect on some of these things here.